Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Y'all, I am so excited because Through the Gryffindor is heading back out on tour. Starting in February of 2025, we'll be performing live shows in Charlotte, Orlando, Tampa, Jacksonville, Atlanta, and Nashville. And as always, we will be bringing all of the magic with a tour-long Jay versus Ben trivia showdown with questions submitted and asked by all of you. And then, of course, we will dim the lights for a live recording of Through the Gryffindor. And y'all, these nights have made for some of my all-time favorite since we have started making content on the internet. It is truly a magical evening, nerding out Harry Potter style with the very best community online. Plus, we have a VIP upgrade for each show if you want to come and meet Jay and I, take photos, ask questions, and score an exclusive signed tour poster before the show begins. We would love to see you. We'd love to meet you, and we hope you will come and join us for all of the fun. Tickets are available in the show notes for every show or at supercarlinbrothers.com. Super Carlin Brothers is sponsored by Nude. Y'all, of course, know about my podcasting and YouTube endeavors, and you may even know that I do some aquarium maintenance at times, but you may not be aware that my wife, Alice, and I also own a business together called Nude. I know it's a funny name, but there's actually a fun story behind it. See, Alice has always had a deep love for clothing and fashion, but even more so for thrifting. It was her way to sustainably and economically expand her wardrobe while still aiming for quality brands that would last. And she is really good at it. Like, I can't tell you the number of times over the years that she has been stopped by people admiring her finds. So much so that she coined a phrase for her response. Thanks, it's nude. As in new, but in the past tense, because it's not exactly new, it's nude. So, we took this concept and created a storefront not 100 yards from where Super Carlin Brothers was created and have an online shop featuring pre-loved clothing from brands like Lululemon, Free People, Anthropologie, Madewell, and so many more. If you'd like to check it out for yourself to ring in the nude year, if you will, you can do so at nudesalem.com and use promo code SUPER to get 20% off your entire order. That's NEWDSalem.com, promo code SUPER for 20% off.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the riddles inside Goblet of Fire, Chapter 5, Weasley's Wizard Wheezes.
This is an interesting chapter, I think.
It is.
So, I think it's kind of funny because I feel like Goblet of Fire so far, you kick off with kind of a doozy with the Riddle House.
Yes.
Like, it's real jam-packed with, like, major information about the whole story.
Yeah.
And it's, like, it's funny to be reading it the way that we're doing it because we sort of compare Harry's dream and the way in which, like, when Harry wakes up,
yeah,
it's almost like the dream is like slipping out of his mind.
Yeah.
And we sort of said, like, I wonder if like the Riddle House is almost like intentionally written to be like very like plot dense.
And then, so that you forget a lot of it.
Because then, you know, as we've gone forward through the next several chapters, it's kind of like not really major things have happened. Like chapter 2, the scar, is just sort of like your recap chapter.
Yeah, Harry's recap a wizard chap.
Like all that type of stuff is going on. The invitation is sort of like life at the Dursleys. And you know, you sort of get like that glimpse into like just how much the Dursleys hate the, you know, the wizarding world, just in case anybody seemed to have forgotten in any capacity there. And then you've got back to the Burrow, which similarly, like, it's
just picking Harry up.
So it's like we've had sort of like chapter on chapter on chapter, and it's not even that I would make the argument that chapter 5, Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, doesn't sort of follow that same trend. Like, it's still continuing on this, like, kind of overall unimportant to the major plot.
It's like, yeah, it's what this chapter is doing is it's starting to like build the bridge from the wizarding world, you know, which is like mostly just Hogwarts, to like the greater international wizarding world.
Yeah.
It's like what it's kind of trying to establish. And it's like, it's planting seeds for lots of things that will come up later. You just don't even realize the seeds are being planted. And even like when you get there later, it's just like, it feels more familiar because you were reminded of it like a little bit earlier.
Right. Yeah. And then the other big detail that I think is kind of fascinating that like I had not normally picked up on, if not for reading the chapter in this particular way, is that I almost feel like this chapter describes two different brands of Weasley children.
I know what you mean.
And I think that like there's like a little bit of like the Molly brand of Weasleys and the Arthur brand of Weasleys. And you're kind of getting like a feel for both and which characters sort of have like one foot parked in both columns.
Yeah.
Versus like which ones are maybe like a little bit more specific to like one side or the other.
Right.
And I just think it's kind of interesting because it's like you think of like the Weasleys as this entity. Like even Draco's got like his famous like, you know, red hair, hand-me-down robes. Like,
yeah.
It almost feels like you can like sort them into a column, but then like there's almost no one more different than Percy and Fred and George.
Right.
Like when we think about like the Poltergeist example, like if Filch is rule abiding and
right.
Peeves is rule breaking, then Percy is fueling Filch.
Yes.
While
Percy
Fred and George
is to Filch as Fred and George are to Peeves.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think you get like really good illustrations of the Weasley dynamic and family, especially with all of them present for this particular chapter, which I think is kind of fun. And before we dive on in, of course, we have to talk about the chapter art, talking about the Weasleys. And what we get here is the depiction of Bill and Charlie dueling with the
Tables.
the tables up in the air, which I personally just think it's like, it's so fun for me to imagine like this nice, beautiful summer day where the family is getting together for a big meal outside and they're just sort of like whimsically using their magic in like a wholly unimportant capacity.
Oh, I know. It's like, it's such like a brother's thing to do. Like it's a very fun inclusion in this chapter because otherwise you really have not met Bill or Charlie at all. Like you've only heard tell of them.
Yes.
Like they've only affected the plot in so much that like Charlie's friends could come cake Norbert or the Weasleys went to Egypt to visit Bill.
Right.
But like, they haven't really been there. So it's like, it's fun that the older brothers get the, get an introduction where they're actually doing a thing and you get kind of like a feel for both of their demeanors. And I love how they're just acting like older brothers. this is exactly what they'd be doing, you know?
Yes. No, I know. Yeah. There's a couple of like really good Bill and Charlie moments, which honestly are scarce. I feel we'll see both Bill and Charlie throughout this year. Charlie for the first half.
Well, this is what I mean. It's like like this chapter, like it does introduce you to Bill and Charlie, and it's like, oh, of course they'd be there because they're all going to the Quidditch World Cup. But like, it's important to remind the reader and introduce you to them because Charlie will be there with the dragons for the first task, and Bill will come to visit Harry, and that's where he'll meet Fleur, and him and Fleur getting married is a huge deal later on. So
yes, it is. Yes, it is indeed. Yep. So lots of good just like Weasley family stuff going on. And then my other just tiny little note before we move on into the actual chapter is that we get a depiction of the burrow in the background, and I quite like it. In the chapter art, that is. And because it's like the way that the burrow is shown, it's like you can kind of tell that it's this like hodgepodge together building, but it's still vaguely resembles a castle.
It vaguely resembles Hogwarts.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I really, really love that depiction of it because, as ever, Harry considers, like, Hogwarts his home.
Yes.
But, like, this is sort of like, but the Burrow's his other home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if it's not Hogwarts, it's certainly the Burrow where he feels the most cared for, the most welcome, you know, and everything else.
Maybe it was even in this book, it was like, it specifically says, like, the Burrow was Harry's, like, favorite building in the magical world aside from Hogwarts or something.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. You might be right.
Yeah.
Yep. So anyway, without any further ado, let's go ahead and dive on in, which basically we're picking up on Harry having left the Dursleys' living room, whipping out of sight through the rush of emerald green flames, of course, the flu powder,
yep.
On his way to the Burrow, and it seems like Harry's got flu powder down at this point.
Which is surprising to me, because last we saw him, he just didn't do it right.
Yeah, so this is his second experience ever. First one, he kind of like whiffs a little bit on.
Yeah.
Attempting to go to Diagon Alley. He has the diagonally.
Yeah.
Which is that like classic, like in case anybody hadn't picked up on the clever wordplay.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's diagonally.
Right. Diagon Alley. Nocturnally. Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly.
You get it? Those are words.
Yes.
That end in alley.
And that end in alley. Yep. But so this time it seems like Harry has sort of got it all figured out because it says Harry spun faster and faster, elbows tucked tightly to his sides, blurred fireplaces flashing past him until he started to feel sick and closed his eyes. Then when at last he felt himself slowing down, he threw his hands out and came to a halt in time to prevent himself from falling face forward out into the Weasley's kitchen fireplace.
Right. So it's like, does it just like stop when you get to the right one?
I know. Yeah. It's kind of funny. It reminds me vaguely of Goblet of Fire, the movie, when there's that scene where they use like the port key and they all kind of like go spinning into space.
Like, yeah.
And then everybody kind of like crashes on the ground at the campsites. And then like you've got this really just Mary Poppins moment with Arthur and Cedric and Amos who are like sort of like air jogging.
In their graceful landing. Yeah. Well, that's Cedric Diggory kid. First, he's dropping out of trees, and now he's Mary Poppinsing. Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
This is a complete aside that makes no bearing and wouldn't possibly come true for at least 6 years. But I was listening to the chapter this morning at Slughorn's party.
Yeah.
When Sanguini the vampire is there.
Yeah.
And I was like, just the best cameo ever would be if Robert Pattinson was Sanguini in the TV show.
I would love it. I would love it.
He has no lines. He says one thing and everyone's like, yeah, we get it.
It's like, oh, he did the thing. He did it. That would be amazing. That would be so crowd pleasery without being like way over the top. And it's like, it's an involvement that he could go and have that would take him
like an hour
afternoon.
Easy
peasy. People would love it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So that's my pitch, Warner Brothers.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. So the first thing that Harry hears upon arriving at the Burrow is, did he eat it? Said Fred excitedly, holding out a hand to pull Harry to his feet.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it? And then I love the name, Tun Tung Toffee. Like, they're so good at naming stuff.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. It's good alliteration going on there to match that Weasley wizard wheezes.
Yeah. And now you learn that Fred and George have been inventing things and looking for someone to test them on. But, like, have they not tested them on themselves yet?
It's even the kind of thing that surprises me. Like, what we're about to learn is that, like, Molly deeply disapproves of Weasley's Wizard Wheezes and, like, burns all the order forms.
Yeah.
And I'm almost surprised that more of, like, the catalyst for this wasn't, like, someone outside of the family or something. Like, I could see Molly getting deeply upset because they gave one to Ron or Ginny or Percy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of like... and she's like, what have you done? No, like,
right.
You
yeah.
Know,
yeah.
And, you know, so it is kind of surprising that none of the Weasleys have had to deal with it. But either which way, I guess they finally got to figure out what they did on Dudley.
They obviously knew what they were going to do.
Yes.
Based on the name. But yeah, I guess what he says, they got to 4 feet before Harry got out of there or something, which is so long. Such a big tongue.
Yes. I mean, so gross. It does sort of like, it makes me sort of like, I feel like I'm like, you know how like when you're sick and you're like, why am I not grateful while I'm healthy? Like,
right.
All those moments.
I'll never take my health for granted again.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like, I feel like just the idea of imagining having a 4 foot tongue makes me like just grateful that I'm like speaking.
That you just have like a regular tongue.
And I can just like swallow normally and everything's fine.
Yeah.
It's like, it like really like, I can't think about it too hard.
Yeah, definitely would be traumatic for Dudley for sure. Although it sounds like Mr. Weasley is able to sort him out, not to without too much trouble or anything.
Yes. It's one of those things where I feel like even Hermione will eventually like applaud Fred and George's sort of ingenuity when it comes to their clever creations.
Yeah, like they're really good at like embedding spells inside of objects.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems like that must be like, I wonder if there's even like a term for like the branch of magic that that would be. Yeah. Is that
imbuing?
Imbuing, yeah. Oh, I mean, that's a Diablo word right there. I mean, I'm sure it's plenty of other words as well. Yeah. But we like Diablo, so we're going to use that as our example. But yeah, it seems like they're really good at doing that. Eventually, they will have the portable swamp that Umbridge can't figure out how to get rid of. It's sort of fun though, because like I think that the ease at which Arthur solves the Tongue Toffee puts him on like a level playing field with like Flitwick, who like makes the swamp go away like with a flick of his wand, except for like the little park that like they like gate off.
Yeah.
It's like a little homage to Fred and George. But I like the fact that like, yeah, it means that like Arthur could easily solve this, but it also makes me think that like Umbridge couldn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think she would, but it's like, it's weird too, because like Umbridge isn't like necessarily bad at magic the way that like Lockhart or Quirrell is bad at magic.
Sure.
You know, like she can still make a Patronus. She can still, you know, she like tries to incapacitate the centaurs, you know, a little bit. Like she can do spells and stuff.
But maybe that's even speaking to a little bit of what I was talking about with like which kind of branch of Weasley do you end up being? Because it like you almost have to have like a whimsical enough mind to be able to reverse engineer what spell they've used in order to then undo said spell.
Right.
Which makes me think that like Arthur, because I would argue that this chapter demonstrates that Arthur is where a little bit more of like the whimsy side of the Weasleys comes from.
Oh, for sure he is.
Yeah.
I mean, he pretty quickly identifies, like he's like, oh, it's just an engorgement charm. Or at least I think it is.
Yes.
You know, but it is like the, through the eyes of someone who has dealt with a lot of magic. It was like, I don't know how you did it, but I can tell, I can see what you did.
Yes. Yeah. You can like kind of like read the traces there based on what's happening before you. So anyway, though, so Harry enters into the kitchen. Everybody's laughing at the Tongue Toffee. He sees two people who didn't immediately know, but must be Bill and Charlie, the two eldest Weasley brothers. And this is, I always think this is like another cool little nod to this exact thing, because we get like good physical descriptions of what some of the Weasleys look like.
Yes.
Which I guess, do we know? Like, I feel like going forward, Ron will always be described as like tall and gangly with like the long nose.
Yeah.
And has he been described that way? Like, I know it in my head and I'm like, is this the first time we're really getting those?
Well, I think it's like, you know, because they're getting like bigger and bigger. So like, I always kind of imagine like when, you know, Harry meets him on the train, they're about the same size.
Okay.
But like, I think since then he has grown taller.
He's grown taller. Okay.
Yeah. But I think he's always been described as like taller than Fred and George.
Okay.
For the
most
part.
Yeah. Yeah. Which sort of fits like the Fred and George like beater. Like
yeah. Beater build, mold.
Kind of
yeah.
what you would imagine for that,
yeah.
that shape. Yeah. So let's see here.
We get the reminder that Charlie works with dragons in Romania, which is of course setting up for the first task later when Charlie will be there to introduce the Hungarian horntail to us.
Yes, yeah. And then it says Charlie was built like the twins, shorter and stockier than Percy and Ron, who are both long and lanky.
Right, so there you go right there. And sure enough, Charlie and Fred and George are the Quidditch players so far.
Yes.
Although of course eventually Ron and Ginny will be as well.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That's a good point. The Weasleys just got Quidditch in their blood.
They got it. Minus, you know. Well, I guess even like, does Percy go out and play with them in the last book? I feel like maybe he did.
In the last book?
Was it in the last book? Maybe it was Chamber. I don't know.
Oh. You mean last book going backwards, not last book going to Deathly
Hallows. Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure he just shows up the Battle of Hogwarts.
Yeah. No. I think he actually does play with them a little like in the summer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe so.
In a rare moment of fun for Percy.
But I think like Hermione's also playing in that particular occasion.
Oh, you might
be
right.
And so it's like, you know, Hermione's not like big on the Quidditch.
She's not. She's not great at flying. Yeah. One of her weaknesses, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if everybody's got to have one, you know.
Everyone's got to have one.
We can cut her some slacks.
Yeah. Weakness in that she still doesn't like flying, but manages to fly to London from Hogwarts on an invisible horse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And then Bill gets to his feet smiling, also shook Harry's hand. Bill came as something of a surprise. Harry knew that he had worked for the Wizarding Bank Gringotts, and that Bill had been head boy at Hogwarts, and Harry had always imagined Bill to be an older version of Percy, fussy about rule breaking and fond of bossing everyone around. However, Bill was, there was no other word for it, cool.
I know. I always really like this line, and I think it's pretty clever writing as well, because almost everything, whenever you're meeting like a new item or person, you get like a pretty detailed description about like how they look or like their features,
yeah,
or whatever. And so it's like usually you are given tons of information, and this is like if you just like, you know, if you were it's fun. This description works because of how detailed everything else is. Like, it's like normally you get a lot of detail about how someone looks, and that's like the norm. And if you were just like, typically, if you were just like introducing a character and you were just at the beginning of the story, to be like, and there showed Dumbledore. He looked really old. Moving on, you know, like that would be like really lazy writing and like not descriptive. But it's like, because you're used to that, the use of a single word and that single word being cool tells you everything you need to know.
Yes. Right? It speaks volumes. We can just dilute it down to like,
exactly,
cool.
Exactly.
Though to be fair, we do get a bit more.
But then you do.
Yeah. Which is that he has hair tied back in a ponytail. He's wearing an earring with looks like a fang dangling from it. Bill's clothes wouldn't have looked out of place at like a rock concert. So like, you know, I'm almost saying that like Bill is almost like the best parts of both like Molly and Arthur a little bit going on here.
Sure. Yeah, like that classic eldest child.
Yeah, right. Says the eldest child.
Yeah, you're right. There's no other word for them, Ben. They're cool. I think it's kind of funny to you because, like, to this point, you've known the eldest Weasley to just be Percy. Like, you know, he's not the oldest, but he's the oldest one there, and he kind of acts like a different version of oldest child, where he's just like enforcing the rules and being the bossy one and kind of like being extra responsible about everything.
Yes. So then we have Mr. Weasley appear out of thin air at George's shoulder. He was looking angrier than Harry had ever seen him. "That wasn't funny," Fred, he shouted. "What on earth did you give that muggle boy?"
That wasn't funny. And I was like, well, I mean, it was funny.
Everyone else thought so.
Everyone was laughing. Yeah, I was just saying.
Oh, man. We talked about this in the last chapter. I do like Fred's rationale for it.
Yes.
At least what it comes down to, because it's not just like, I mean, it's cruel no matter what, but like at least he's coming from a non completely terrible perspective. Let's see here. So basically he's just like, "I just dropped it." You know, it's like, it wasn't my fault that he ate it. And Mr. Weasley is like, "You knew he ate it. And you knew he was on a diet." And then George can't help himself. "How big did his tongue get?"
Yeah. I love how well Mr. Weasley just knows his sons too. He's like, "Not an accident. Don't buy it for a second."
Yes, absolutely. This is a moment where I feel like it would be so funny in the TV series if like George like pulls out like a notepad and is always like, "How big did his tongue get?"
Taking notes.
Yes.
Market research.
Yes, precisely. So that's when we learned that it was 4 feet long before his parents would let me shrink it, which I can't even imagine what was going on at the Dursleys when it got to 4 feet.
And oh, I know.
That's the point where they're like, okay, step in.
What to do something, fix it.
Right.
Yeah, right. I can also just imagine like, it feels hard that like, and you kind of get this feeling even just later down the page that like at this point after he says it was 4 feet and everyone laughs, I can't imagine Mr. Weasley isn't just sort of like, you know, a little in on the joke. Like he understands that like it was hilarious, but it's like, as a parent, I must remain firm on this.
Dude, this is the perspective that I think at the very least I only received once I became a parent.
Yeah.
Was the realization that at times when your parents are upset, it's because they need to teach you, not because they are upset themselves.
Yeah.
Like in my mind, it was like every time I upset mom and dad, it was because they were actually angry.
Right.
Not that they didn't need to set like a good example or precedent for behaviors.
Right.
And you're right. It does feel a little bit like you can imagine like Arthur like kind of has one of those like Dumbledore like mustache twitch moments. Like,
right.
Like, okay, it was kind of funny. But
it was kind of funny, yeah.
But this sort of behavior seriously undermines wizard muggle relations. And he's like, "My own sons." And this is where Fred points out, "We didn't give it to him because he was a muggle. No, we gave it to him because it's a great bullying git," said George. "Isn't he, Harry?"
Yeah.
And so I do appreciate the distinction here, because it's like basically what we know about the Weasleys in general is that they're like notorious like blood traitors, which is a good thing. It means that they are not determined to maintain blood purity in any way. They don't have prejudice towards muggle-born people. It's basically saying like, no, this has nothing to do with the fact that he's muggle.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
This has to do with the fact that he's mean.
Right.
And you know, so there's that.
Yeah, it comes off maybe like, yeah, it's a great counter argument. I feel like it comes off a little interesting in this book where, like, Dudley, whilst they were there, was not mean.
That's true.
For the most part, was like actually incredibly scared.
That's also
and then something happened. Yeah,
that's a very good point. Yeah, he is the one who, when it comes to magic, has had a bad experience and has reason to be scared.
Of
such things. So that's a good point. Good call there.
Yeah. Although don't feel too bad for Dudley. He will open the next book by like beating up 10-year-olds with a gang of teenagers. So
there is that as well.
Yeah. So there's that. That's not great.
This next line though, I think, is where we really start to get like a feel for the difference between the two types of Weasleys that there are.
Yeah.
Because you wait until I tell your mother. This is the moment where I feel like it's clear to me that Mr. Weasley is trying to prove a point.
Oh yeah.
Because it's like when you scroll down the page, like, what happens next is that Miss Weasley walks into the room.
Yeah, as he's saying this.
Tell me what, Arthur?
Yeah.
And Harry could tell, however angry he was with Fred and George, he hadn't really intended to tell Mrs. Weasley what had happened.
Oh, I know. I love that. It reminds me so much of like when she comes in and she's like, your sons flew that car of yours halfway across, you know.
Surrey and back last night.
Yeah, to Surrey and back last night. He goes, did you really? How did it go? Like, oh, that was very wrong, boys. It's like very much the same energy happening in the room.
Yes.
Sort of like in reverse, because now he's the one who has to give the news instead of the one who's hearing the news.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I feel like that's kind of like one of those things where it's like, it makes me believe that Arthur has a lot of this whimsy living inside of his own perspective.
Oh, I mean, I mean, he wrote a loophole into a actual law so that he could tinker with stuff.
Like he the twins are well reflected in Arthur.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Like, I think that's where they're getting that behavior from. Where I would argue that I think that Percy is getting a lot of his personality, like almost more purely distilled from Molly,
right?
Even if he's got more of like a an Arthur physical appearance.
I mean, even just based on what's going to happen with Bill and Charlie, like fighting the tables later, like you can tell, like they were both like perfectly respectable, like students who were like mostly well behaved and did what they were supposed to. But there was like still a certain amount of like rule breaking carefreeness. And I can imagine if you're the Percy Weasley who was the youngest brother at that point, realizing that like, oh, Bill and Charlie are great, but like the way I can set myself apart and really stand out to like mom is to like really follow the rules.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that that's like Percy walking to the beat of Molly's drum, maybe more so than Arthur's.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, down to the point where even later in this chapter, she's going to say like, oh, Fred and George, you know, or Ron's going to say she wants them to go into the ministry.
Yes.
And it's like, and guess who's the only one who's gone into the ministry?
Percy.
It's Percy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He is trying to do everything he can to please what his mother's version of like perfection is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see here. So this is where he, Arthur though, is eyeing his wife nervously. Let's see here. The two girls appeared in the kitchen doorway behind Mrs. Weasley. This is sort of like one of those moments where it's like people enter the room that can sort of like dispel the tension a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, Hermione and Ginny, both of whom smile at Harry, who grins back, and Ginny goes, Scarlet.
Yeah.
Because at this point in time, she still hasn't quite broken out of that shell yet.
Just notice that both of them smile at him, though. Just notice that. You know, look, we know that Ginny has a crush on him, and she smiles at him. So Hermione smiles at him, ipso facto, at this point, also, therefore. I'm just putting it out there. Also, we get the description of Hermione that says, one with very bushy brown hair and rather large front teeth, which the large front teeth isn't, like, you always get the bushy hair when it comes to Hermione. The large front teeth, though, is being brought up here specifically because Hermione's going to have, like, her little makeover later in the book.
Yes.
And this is just to remind you that she has big teeth because later on, like, she's going to get, like, super long teeth courtesy of, like, Malfoy's spell, I think. Yeah, it's going to like ricochet in there. So this is all, it's being pointed out to you because it's going to be changed later.
Exactly. Yep. So just a little reminder of what's going on there.
Yes.
And then so basically this is Molly Doubling Down being like, tell me what, Arthur? And this is where Arthur is definitely like, okay, let's rein it back in because I didn't plan for this to be like a huge problem.
Right. And now he's trying to hedge.
Yes. He's like, Fred and George, but I've had words with him.
Yes. And then she's like, she's obvious. She zeroes in on it immediately. It's like, if it's got anything to do with Weasley's wizard wheezes. Oh, it's so fun. And Hermione's like, we got to bounce. Let's go.
Yeah. It's like, although I love the fact that Ron misses the beat. Like, why don't we show Harry where he's sleeping? And Ron's like, he knows where he's sleeping.
He knows where he's sleeping. Come
in
on,
my room. He's up there last time. We can all go, said Hermione pointedly. Oh, said Ron, cottoning on. I was just sort of like, I like that phrasing.
Great word. Yeah, good. Yeah. I love how George tries to like cotton on as well.
Yeah. We'll come too, said George.
Yeah, nice try.
I literally wrote, not a bad try, though.
Yeah. Well, we better be getting to bed.
Yep. What is it, 4 p.m.?
Yeah, big day tomorrow, you know. Yep.
Actually, I think based on the previous chapter, we know that it's approximately 5:45.
Oh, do we?
Well, because remember, they were supposed to be like 5, and then they're like a half hour late.
You're right.
And, you know, however long it took for the Tung-Tung Toffee antics.
So. Right. Roughly dinner time.
Yeah.
So then I love the description of the stairs as well, just up the rickety stairs that zigzagged through the house to the upper stories. Like, this is one of those things they really capture well in the movies, because there's really absolutely no reason for stairs to look this way in a house.
True.
Like they should not be zigzagging just like through the center of the house. But I love it when they're all like looking down and like, sure enough, that's how it's built.
Yes.
And it's just like, it's like there's no reason for that, but that is absolutely how I would want it, you know?
No, I know. It's so great. But, and it's just another one of those examples of, like, the Burrow being kind of similar to, like, the moving staircases.
At Hogwarts. They're just sort of zigzagging around, you know?
Like, I'm wondering.
I know.
I don't know if I've ever picked up on this before, but it does sort of make me think that, like, the Burrow is like a tiny little version of Hogwarts.
The Burrow was a dragon?
The Burrow was a dragon! And what does Charlie do for work?
Mm-hmm.
Coincidence?
I know. Although it said it started out as a pigsty, so that's also...
So maybe coincidence.
Maybe the Burrow was a pig.
The Burrow was a pig. Yeah, there we go. Harry is asking about Weasley's wizard wheezes, and Ron and Ginny both think it's funny, although Hermione didn't. This, I think, is another example of, like, as much as Ginny may take after Molly, she also certainly has, like, a considerable amount of that Fred and George.
Yeah, she's like a good balance of the two parents.
She is. Yeah. Yes, indeed. So she definitely still has like the sense of humor about her, and she can sort of see where it's like kind of whimsy. And basically, yeah, what we discover is that Mom found the stack of order forms when she was cleaning Fred and George's room. Great long price lists for stuff that they've invented, joke stuff, you know, fake wands and trick suites, loads of stuff. It was brilliant. I never knew they'd been inventing all of that. And then it's sort of like one of those moments where you're like, yeah, Fred and George are flat out just ignoring the underage magic rule.
Oh, I know. That is so true. It's like they're clearly just doing magic all the time. And it's like it's funny because like this is like the weird advantage you have if you come from a wizarding family, because like if you're just doing magic at your house, like it doesn't like the ministry can detect that magic was done but not who's doing it.
Yeah.
But if your whole family is wizards, then they just have to assume. Like, they give the parents the benefit of the doubt that they're enforcing the rules.
Right.
Like, they're not going to go investigate every little spell that happens everywhere all the time.
Right.
And, like, but then, like, for Harry, it's super unfair because, like, obviously any magic done in number 4 Privet Drive is clearly him.
Exactly.
Even when it's not.
When it's Dobby, yeah.
Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Shopify. Right, let me just say this. Ben is prone to having ideas, like lots of ideas. And as his older brother, it can surely be a double-edged sword. Like some are fun to imagine, but how to even begin executing them is often the issue. And this is the case when it came to merch. Like even back in college, Ben would make these great graphics and Windows paint and send them off to screen printers and give them to, you know, me for the holidays, and they looked great, bro, definitely. They were so good. I always thought this aspect of content creating would be so much fun. The trouble was, how do we even start? And that is where Shopify comes in clutch. Their easy-to-use templates and user-friendly interface makes it so easy to go at what I like to call Ben speed, or in more common terms, 0 to 60. Now we have a blast working together to come up with amazing new merch ideas for all of our shows, including this one. It's no secret, businesses want to grow, so grow with Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout we use with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/griffin, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/griffin to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/griffin.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
I know. So it definitely is like one of those advantages, but it's funny because, like, you know, I think Percy probably came home for the summer and would go up and like maybe be like a little bit like more in Hermione based behavior, like read all of the textbooks and be,
yeah,
you know, like
very studious
about it. And it's like what Fred and George are doing. I mean, they're getting in reps. You know, like if you were a high school athlete and you got home and did nothing but go out to your basketball hoop in the backyard and just shot,
yeah,
all summer, it's like you're
going to get a lot better.
Exactly. And yeah. So I think it's like, you know, the way in which Fred and George and their ambitions are misunderstood by probably more Molly than anything in this particular chapter, it really is kind of interesting because it's like they're working very hard, just not in
a state of hypocrisy that's going to be happening here in a couple of sentences or whatever. But I also love in that sentence where he says, you know, fake wands and trick suites, loads of stuff. It was brilliant. I never knew they'd been inventing all that. Like, I love how proud Ron is of them. Like,
yes.
He's so impressed. Like, there's no like jealousy or like feeling left out. He's just like, that was so like, well done.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. You're absolutely right. Especially from Ron too, who does kind of like, that is like his cross to bear in the Weasley household.
Yeah.
Like being, you know, and maybe it's maybe it's really good for Ron, like what Fred and George are doing, because they're acting in a way like that is so discernible from, you know, like the head boys of the, you know, elder brothers before him.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, okay, it's nice to see like this is like a helpful dose of like humility maybe,
yeah,
that he's got coming out of him,
right?
You know, and so it's actually just really cool that Fred and George can actually even provide that to the family dynamic.
Yeah. And then he does admit, like, well, most of it, well, all of it really was a bit dangerous. And, you know, they're planning to sell it at Hogwarts to make some money. And Mom went mad at them. And that, I underline that. And I'm like, why? Why is that such a bad thing, you know, that they were going to, like, sell it, stuff they paid? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe it's just sort of like that idea. Like, I mean, it's funny because you're right. Like, it's almost like that is ambition.
You know, I know.
Like, and I think she's about to say that they have no
ambition. I know, it's so weird. Or it's like she can't see the forest for the trees.
Exactly.
Or something a little bit.
Yeah.
And then it's I love it. So like she burned all their order forms, and I'm like, of all the things, that seems like the easiest thing to remake.
I know. I'm always like, that's not a setback.
I know, that's not really a setback. So like, why did she burn the sweets or the products? You know,
right. No.
Yeah.
Those are way more well hidden.
Yeah, she didn't find any of those. But I guess we revealed that they didn't get as many OWLs as she expected. And they had a big row because Mom wants them going to the Ministry of Magic like Dad, and they told her all they wanted to do was open a joke shop. And it's like, it is surprising to me that Molly has taken this tack with Fred and George. Like, I'm not sure if she's just mad about the OWLs or something, but like, you know, she's upset that they like want to start a joke shop, which is just like, I don't know. It seems so weird because it's not as if Bill and Charlie are in the Ministry of Magic either. You know, like Charlie is, does he even have a job? You know, it always says he's out studying dragons, and like Bill is a treasure hunter. Like neither of those are ministry jobs, you know?
Right. Like, yeah. I mean, in hunting treasure seems more in line with what Fred and George are going for here, just through a different means.
Right, just like different means. So it's like, of your three kids with jobs, only one of them actually works at the ministry, and you don't seem upset with Bill or Charlie, though.
I know. I think it's the OWLs being folded in there, but this is another point that I would want to bring up just more for like out of universe reasons, but like students like this do exist in the real world. Like students who can't seem to grapple onto like the traditional educational like examination type things, but it's not for a lack of brilliance, creativity, or talent. It's just sort of like the way in which they're able to direct their energies doesn't yield great like marks.
Right.
But it's like those people will still go on to do great things.
Right.
You know, so it's like, I feel like, you know, it's like one of those things where it's like, it's okay to be Fred and George.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. On the other hand, we have Percy sticking his head out. Oh, hello, Harry. I was wondering we're making all that noise. I'm trying to work in here, you know. Got a report to finish for the office, and it's rather difficult to concentrate when people keep thundering up and down the stairs. To which I'm just like, bro, you're at home, man, okay? Like, you have a job now. Why are you still even living there? Like, go, like, move out if it's such a problem. No one's making you do work right now.
Right.
You know, this is your problem.
It really is. It really is. I mean, I highlighted that whole interaction because I was just like, it never takes long with Percy. Like, he's so well, like, crafted to where it's like everybody has known this person in their life.
Yeah.
And you just, you're like, yeah.
You're like, yeah, mm-hmm.
A little bit of a wet blanket on the situation there.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, things are more important. I'm working for a report for the Department of International Magical Cooperation.
Right.
We're trying to standardize cauldron thickness. some of these foreign imports are just a shade too thin. Leakage have been increasing at a rate of almost 3% a year. You're like, dude, chill.
It's like, I mean, it is a hilariously unimportant sounding thing.
I mean, it absolutely is. And like Ron knows it. He's like, unless some sort of international law is imposed, we might find the market flooded with flimsy, shallow bottom products that seriously, like,
yeah,
shallow bottoms.
Yeah, yeah. All right. All right. Yeah. Said Ron. He started off upstairs again. Percy slammed his bedroom door shut.
Yeah. It's so silly because it's like, on the one hand, it's like Fred and George are clearly taking all their joke stop stuff very seriously.
Yeah.
Like they're doing order forms, they're planning for the future, they're trying to sell stuff. And it's like somehow they're taking it seriously in the right way. And Percy is taking it seriously in the wrong way.
I know.
Like, I don't know where the line is, but like clearly there's a line.
I mean, and maybe it's like one of those things where it's like it's one of them is more fun, which makes it then therefore like more relatable. But like to me, what really stands out here is that like what you end up having is like Percy, Fred, and George don't seem similar to each other at all. But realistically, what you've got is three brothers, all of whom lock themselves in their room to work very hard on the things that matter to them.
Exactly.
And it's sort of like, it's like, these are all people. It's like what the Weasleys share is the like setting of their intentions based on what matters most to them and chasing that thing.
Right. But you can definitely see like the Molly Weasley of it all in the center of it, because like Percy is sort of like a wet blanket to everyone all the time,
right?
But he's the one Molly's really proud of,
right?
Even though, but you're right, it's the same situation. If you just like, you know, go up to the stairs, turn left, that's Percy's room, to the right, that's the twins' room or whatever,
right?
You know, it's like over here, and it's like the same situation. Like, you're right, they're holed up in their rooms working hard on what matters to them,
yeah.
And it's like Percy, she's proud of, even though he's kind of rude to everybody. Fred and George are a laugh and everyone loves them, but she's upset with them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But then what I think is kind of like interesting is that like you might think like Percy doesn't have any of that like good-natured Weasley in him. Like it's almost like he got like, you know, dealt like the unusual what is the formula, I guess, where he's like way, 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 way more like tilted to like one side, like that rule following nature or whatever. But it's kind of fascinating to me that the very last thing that Fred will say to Percy before Fred dies at the Battle of Hogwarts is like, you're joking, Pess. And it's like, it's fascinating to me because I almost feel like that's Percy like finally letting down a lot of like the barriers that I think he like built in his brain to try to avoid engaging in these kinds of behaviors. But it's not for a lack of existing within him.
Right.
You know, it's almost like you get to see like the best version of Percy finally emerge right there at the end. And we don't get to spend enough time with like that version of the character.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Yeah. It's too bad. It's too bad. But from there, we do get to head up to Ron's room where I thought this was just interesting. It said, Harry notices a fish tank on the windowsill, which had previously held frog spawn, now contained one extremely large frog, which I was like, you know, I don't know why I never put it together that frog spawn would grow into a frog.
You know, this one throws me because I have done lots of saltwater aquariums,
yeah,
and one of like the most universally popular coral is called frog spawn,
yeah,
which is it's an LPS coral, which,
sure,
you know, large polyp, stony,
yeah,
and basically it resembles actual frog spawn, like, mm-hmm, you know, like from frogs, which is why it is called that. But the fact that it was in an aquarium, I always just imagine him having a tank full of frog spawn coral. Wow. So you're right. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And, yeah. But one extremely large frog.
One extremely large frog.
Who is taking care? He's only there for 8 weeks.
I know. It's like Neville brought a toad to school and you like lost Scabbers. Like you had a frog. Dude, come on.
Maybe Ron's like, I'm not bringing that to school.
Not bringing that to school. I'm not Neville. Come on, dude. As if. Also, did we learn that it says Fred and George are in here with us because Bill and Charlie are in their room? So that's interesting. I was like, so when Bill and Charlie were at home, where did everybody sleep? Was this the arrangement ahead of time? Like before? Like, did they not have their own rooms? Or was just like, you know, like, did Ginny take over one of their rooms or something? Or why don't they have their own rooms?
I suppose being the only girl in the family maybe would grant you having your own bedroom.
I suppose.
And I mean, it's interesting because it does make you wonder whether or not this was like plotted out. Like how long was everybody simultaneously, like how much older are Bill and Charlie to the rest of the Weasleys? And is there a world where you wouldn't have needed that extra bedroom?
Well, like Bill would have to be like 17 years older than Ginny.
Yeah.
Right.
In order for this to work,
yeah,
exactly as we imagine it. Which, let's see here. So Ginny is currently, yeah, I mean, so Ginny is currently what, 13? Because
right,
she'll be going into her third year. It does feel hard to imagine a scenario where Bill or Charlie is 30. And I'm pretty sure we know that Charlie is only a couple of years out of Hogwarts.
Right.
Because they sort of talk about like his tenure on the Gryffindor Quidditch team having been like recent to like Oliver Wood and
right,
all of that. Like McGonagall references Charlie.
Yeah, like he only seems like maybe like 1 year removed from Hogwarts by the time Harry gets there.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
or
right,
two, right, maybe.
Yeah.
So yeah, hard to say. But like, okay, let's see. We know that Ron has a bedroom, Percy has a bedroom, Ginny has a bedroom, Fred and George have a bedroom. So that's 4 bedrooms plus presumably Molly and Arthur have a bedroom. So it's a 5-bedroom house for 7 or 9 people.
Yeah.
Right? So, and like you'd assume that like, you know, okay, they have Bill. Bill gets his own room. That makes sense. Then they have Charlie. Charlie gets his own room. That makes sense. We only have 2 kids.
Right.
Then we have Percy. Percy gets his own room. That makes sense. We only have 3 kids.
Fred and George.
Fred and George come together. They get their own room.
Right.
Right. That makes sense because they share because they're twins. That, you know, I can see that math going here. We've got now, though, all of the rooms are full. Right. Now, all of the rooms are full. So now we have Ron. Where does he go? Right.
Maybe that's when I was going to say, because he's like sort of like in the attic.
Yeah.
Up like with the ghoul.
No.
Beneath the ghoul.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, like, you know, is Ron's room like made?
Right.
Like, but no, I don't think that's how it works.
I don't know.
Okay. I can't follow.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Where does he go? Do then they move Bill and Charlie into a room together? That would seem like suddenly unfair to them, you know?
Right. Me as the middle child, remembering growing up, me and you sharing a room for quite some time where our younger brother Tyler was born.
Uh-huh.
And then at some point in time, you were given the room.
Yeah.
And then me and Tyler had to share rooms.
Correct.
And so I was the last one to ever have a room to myself.
Well, I don't know what to tell you, Ben.
I mean, I guess maybe Tyler had it worse because he had his own room taken from him.
He wanted to share a room with you.
Oh, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I see what's happening.
Yeah.
Here. Well, I was a good roommate, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Good chatterbox.
You had the top bunk. Okay.
Sorry. And now we're way off the train. Okay. So what else do we see inside of Ron's room? Ron's old cat Scabbers was here no more, but instead there was a tiny gray owl that had delivered Ron's letter to Harry and Privet Drive. It was hopping up and down in a small cage, twittering madly.
Yeah.
This was just a detail I pulled aside here, but remember when we visited the post office in Hogsmeade?
Yeah.
They refer to the smallest owls as tiny little Scops owls for local deliveries only.
Ah.
And so I'm just curious whether or not Pigwidgeon is a Scops owl.
Is a Scop, and so they're just making him do larger than life deliveries.
Like I mean, maybe it's like, you know, maybe as a Scops owl, Pigwidgeon is actually killing it.
Oh, I mean, that seems to be the case. And I love how Ron like immediately just treats Pigwidgeon like, oh, he's being stupid. He won't answer to anything else. And he annoys me too. And it's like Harry knew Ron too well to take him seriously. He'd moan continually about his old rat Scabbers, but I'm most upset when Hermione's got Crookshanks appeared to have eaten him. And I'm like, I'm surprised Ron's even taking this tack at all. But it's like, dude, your owl was given to you by escaped convict Sirius Black. Like, that's so cool.
Yes, right? Like the way in which you got to like come to own an owl. Like, especially because I have to imagine Molly and Arthur, like, you know, Ron comes home from the train. He's like, look, Mom and Dad, I've got an owl.
Like,
and
where? They're like,
how?
Yeah.
Like, you're not a prefect.
Found him.
Yeah.
I found him. What did I tell you?
I climbed a tree.
Got an owl now, so it's fine. It's cool. Yeah. I took it, and now it's mine. So there you go.
There you go.
Yep.
But I do think, like, and this was something I wanted to outline a little bit, because, like, it almost makes me think that, like that Ron has got, like, a too big of an issue with, like, negative self-talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like he is, like, determined for everything that he has to, like, he's seeing it all in the wrong light a little bit.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I can understand where he's coming from, just because I do think that, like, a huge piece of like I said before, you know, his like character model is trying. I mean, it's what he saw in the Mirror of Erised. It's himself as Quidditch captain and winning the house cup,
yeah,
and
head boy and all,
yeah,
that.
Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, living up to those expectations.
The best of all of them.
Right, right, right. But he, I don't know. So I'm curious a little bit if, like, maybe that's what happens. Cause I mean, he'll get like his dress robes later on, which are, you know, they sound like they're a hard hand.
Yeah, this is a tough hand to be dealt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, I'm like, you know, you seemed excited about Pigwidgeon when you got it at the train at the end of last year. And I'm kind of sad to see that you're not like more jazzed about it now.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Right.
Yeah.
But anyway, so then we also get dumped out on Crookshanks out chasing gnomes in the garden. And then, which I have a note about Crookshanks later on. I'll get to that.
Okay. Okay. That sounds good. Sounds good.
Yeah. But then, yeah, we get to hear about Percy's work for the ministry, and Ron is just like, oh, enjoying it. I don't reckon he'd come home if Dad didn't make him. He's obsessed. And then we get introduced. This is also like clever writing. We're often introduced to characters before they appear themselves.
Yes.
So this is your first introduction to Mr. Crouch and what you know him. So how you're mentally going into meeting Barty Crouch is that he is someone Percy, the wet blanket, looks up to the utmost.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yeah. To the point where Ron ends his impersonation, according to Mr. Crouch, as I was saying, Mr. Crouch is of the opinion they'll be announcing their engagement any day now.
Yeah, I underlined that and said, yeah, if Barty can never learn his name.
Weatherby. Something, yes, that when we were kids, we thought was the funniest thing ever.
Because it is.
Yeah.
I know. I love. And then Harry at the bottom, or they ask about, did the food parcels get there? And says, yeah, thanks a lot. They saved my life, those cakes, which I just highlighted and said, wizard debt.
You know,
saved his life. Now you owe everybody.
Now you know everybody. Which, yep. I mean, he does die for everybody.
He does. So he does pay it.
I think
he pays. Perhaps this is the establishing catalyst.
You know what? In fact, I think that as self-proclaimed Harry Potter experts, this, guys, in fact, this is it. This is the moment. Harry has to die for everybody because of the cakes.
The cakes saved his life.
They saved,
okay,
his life. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're joking.
That's not it.
That's not it.
This is hyperbole. Yeah. Let's see. Then we get a little bit of update on Sirius Black and are reminded that nobody but themselves and Dumbledore knew that Sirius had escaped or believed in his innocence, which is, again, I can't believe Ron doesn't think his owl is cooler. I wonder what, you're right, I wonder what lie he told them, because came from Sirius Black is probably not going to fly.
Probably not going to be terribly acceptable,
yeah,
in the eyes of Molly and Arthur.
Yeah, yet.
Especially because, yeah, it's like, you know, they will come to know him, but even then, like, once they know him, I feel like Molly and Sirius are always at odds,
yeah,
with each other. So it's like, even then, it would feel like if like Ron came home and was like, yeah, Sirius got me an owl, she'd be like, I disapprove.
Yeah. Also, okay, this is the next sentence. What happens is, so they get up there, they hear the arguing is stopped, and they say, should we go back down and help your mom with dinner? So I'm like, they, like, here's what happened. They walked all the way up the stairs, and then Harry said, why is that called pigwidgeon? I don't know. Percy likes his job? Yup. Have you heard from Sirius? A little. Let's go back downstairs. Like, yeah. They basically walk up there and walk right back down.
And even the, have you heard from Sirius, doesn't get finished because Ginny is in the room.
Yeah.
So from Ginny's perspective, she's like, what was the point of walking all the way up here?
I know. Yeah. And it's like at the very top of the house through all the zigzag staircases. Yep. Nope. So yeah, I was just like, boy, they barely got up there.
I know.
And then immediately turned around. As they're heading out to go help Bill and Charlie set up for dinner outside, you get to kind of continue to see this like weird relationship that Molly has with the twins at this exact moment, because like she points her wand and she knocks a bunch of potato skins out of the sink or whatever. And as she's fixing it, Harry just sort of hears her like muttering to herself, like, those two, no ambition unless you can't make it as much trouble as you possibly can. And it's like, that she's saying this about Fred and George as if Bill and Charlie aren't out in the garden fighting tables in the sky at this exact moment.
I know. You're absolutely correct. Like, it's fun. It's interesting because it does almost seem like the fact, I don't know, I'm trying to decide like whether or not like this would happen in families or not, like where there's a degree of like once you've left the nest, or is it because like they fell into those molds of like head boy, Quidditch captain, like that it's sort of like
right.
their behavior is like more excusable because they like they did some of the things that they were like were air quotes supposed to do,
right? Like maybe like she disapproved, but like clearly the staff is recognizing you, so I trust you more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Whereas, like, yeah. She mostly hears a lot about a troublemaking from these two.
Right.
And now
right.
they're not getting good grades, and they want to start a joke shop, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, but at the same, yeah, but it is just funny to see, like, through the eyes of her, like clearly the other kids are the same. Like, they're just out there, like, having a table fight, you know?
I know. Absolutely. Yeah. And, yeah, so I highlighted and underlined, like, the no ambition part and was, like, incorrect.
But oh, then, I know. I said that. I said, I mean, not true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then on literally the very next page, you get the line from her that says, it's not as though they haven't got brains. And I was like,
yes.
Correct. Like, you know, it's like, it's that's just another layer of that. Like, it's like she can recognize that they're smart.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love the ways in which this truth permeates the story with Fred and George in particular.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, like I said before, like Hermione is going to be impressed with the kind of magic they can do. Umbridge can't get rid of the swamp that they do. They end up being like the single business that's thriving despite like everything being down. Like,
yeah.
You know, they're like really, truly creating amazing stuff.
Yeah.
It's just almost like you just got to let them like kind of spread their
wings and
fly. Gotta
let them go. Yeah, yeah. Right. Exactly. Also, there's just like I just highlighted this as well because we're getting more about Molly cooking, and it says she gave her wave her wand around. A creamy sauce poured from the wand tip as she stirred, and I'm like, does this violate some kind of like Gamp's like law of transfiguration or whatever?
Elemental transfiguration.
Elemental transfiguration. Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely a curiosity unless she made the creamy sauce in like a pot somewhere.
Right.
And she is like siphoning it through magic.
That is what I have to assume is happening, because otherwise she's making food out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think that just has to we based on the laws of magic, we must assume that is what's happening.
Oh, okay. All right,
yeah.
Then.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. So she is just taking it from the pot and being able to re-divert it.
Do you imagine that there is like spells you can put on food so like they won't decay or like they won't go bad?
I imagine so.
Because then you could like make a because one of the other like laws of food or whatever is that like if you have some, you can make more of it.
Yes.
So you could like make this creamy sauce, put the spell on it so that it won't decay, and then just leave it in the fridge like forever.
Forever.
Because you could just make more of it whenever you want and just be like, because you can make more of it if you have it, right?
Theoretically.
That'd be amazing.
It would be kind of cool.
That's
it
pretty cool. Kinda, yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, that's yeah, pretty good yeah, wizard yeah, hack right there.
It's not so saying, bad. I mean, I wonder if anybody's ever thought of that.
I mean, I think it sounds like Molly has, you know?
Well, I mean, okay, that is one of the things, though, and we talk about, like, we have a whole string of videos about the economies of how, like, you know, money works in the wizarding world and stuff, and it's just very, very different because, you know, it's like, despite being, you know, like, self-proclaimed or described as being, like, poor in the story, it's not as though the table they're about to eat dinner on isn't groaning under the weight of all of the excellent cooking.
Yeah.
So it's like there is, like, maybe they can't afford the things that they can't make of their own accord, but the things that they can magically concoct, they're plentiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Harry is, like, well-fed whenever he goes there.
Yeah.
You know, so there is that. So it seems like something must be going on.
Yeah.
To that tune.
Yes, it does.
Let's see here. So then as we continue on down the page, Molly's still sort of going. She's like, I don't know where we went wrong with them. To which I want to pause right here because I feel like we have been, like, describing Molly in a slightly negative light through this chapter, which is not how I feel about Molly at all.
No, me neither. Yeah.
She's incredible. And I think ultimately it's even well executed as time goes on, where once Fred and George are successful, they spoil the heck out of Molly.
Oh, yes. Like, they absolutely do.
I don't think they've ever felt not loved. And I think they will eventually recognize that she only wanted what was best for them. She just didn't quite have the vision to see what they were going to do.
Right. I mean, she even admits out loud, she's like, well, I must admit, I was concerned at first, but they do seem to have a flair for business.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Go ahead.
Yeah, let's see. So next we have, what, several knives. Sword out of it, flew across the kitchen and began chopping the potatoes, which had just been ticked back into the sink. I just think magical cooking seems fun.
It does.
Like there's all the little, like, household spells that she's doing to do it. It's like she can, even if you have the food and make it, like, you still have to cook it, you know?
Yes. So there's like a lot of, like, it honestly reminds me a lot of, like, programming, like a programming language, where it's like, I feel like if you were to like magically be, like, setting all these commands into place, you would need to have good mastery of all the commands themselves. You would need to know the order, and you would need to execute them properly in that order so that, like, the right things happen at the right times.
Yeah.
You know, over and over again. So I can see it being more complicated than kind of meets the eye with, like, the wave of the wand or whatever.
Yeah.
And it does remind me a little bit of that scene from the first Fantastic Beasts movie.
I was just going to bring that up.
Where Queenie is making just, like, this, like, super incredible, extravagant,
dude,
like,
she makes that strudel thing.
Yeah.
But she, like, cooks that in midair, too.
She does.
Like,
she
that,
does.
Like, yeah. So that's, like, a little bit, I wonder what's happening there. She, like, she has all the ingredients, but she's, like, single wand waves it into a cooked pastry in front of Jacob in, like, 10 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, that's high level artistry at that point.
That is high. I mean, Queenie is clearly very talented at this particular thing. So yeah, just point that out there. I love that scene. It's so satisfying.
It really is.
I'm like, I want to eat that food.
And then I love then later on in the series when she's, like, feeding him, like, slop.
I know. Yeah.
It's like weird pasta mush mash.
Right. Yeah. She's gone a little off the rails at that point.
A little bit. Yeah.
Oh, well. And then, guys, it's poor timing. Molly picks up one of the fake wands. Like, how many times have I told them not to leave them lying around? And it's like, the irony in this exact moment is that, like, that she's upset with them, even though they've made a product that successfully fooled her.
Exactly.
It's like, their artistry is so good.
It is. Yeah. It's like, yeah. Because, I mean, you, at this point in time, Molly has had her wand for decades.
Yeah.
And they have just successfully created a wand that looked so similar that she mistakenly picked up the wrong one.
Yeah.
After she presumably had just set it down.
Yeah. So a little shout out to them is there, even though she's not that impressed in the moment. But such bad timing to be like, you're mad at somebody for something, and then another thing happens.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let's see. But then we got our little update on Crookshanks here, who's chasing gnomes around the garden. Let's see. It says one of the gnomes dived headlong into one of the Wellington boots that lay scattered around the door. Harry could hear the gnome giggling madly as Crookshanks inserted a paw into the boot. Okay, so two things here. One, I think I realized something here. I think Crookshanks is really bad at hunting.
Oh, that's kind of funny.
Like, think about this. Crookshanks fails to catch scabbers for an entire year.
Yeah.
And the gnomes Harry can pick them up right off the ground.
Yeah.
You know? I think Crookshanks is really bad at hunting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good observation.
Yeah. Like, yeah. The Scabber survives not because he's so crafty. It's like Crookshanks is just bad at this.
I sort of love it because it takes away any amount of credit you could give to Peter, which is one of my favorite things to do.
I know. Yeah, I don't like giving Peter credit for just about anything. But then also, I have a very fun fact about Wellington boots.
Oh, lay it on me, because I literally underlined this and I was like, so often when I was reading these books as a kid, I always kind of like felt bad for just not knowing what Wellington boots were.
Yeah. Yes.
So go ahead. Fire at will.
Okay. So they're basically just rain boots.
Okay.
Right. You know, they're like big rubber boots that you might wear out in like the garden or if it was raining or something. In case you're wondering what they were, because that was one of those things. I'm like, Wellington boots, is that like a British thing? Is that a brand? I guess it's more like a... Maybe it is a brand, but it's like, you know, everyone would just call any rubber boots Wellington boots, I think.
Oh, sure. Like a Kleenex type situation.
Yeah. However,
it is capitalized for what it's
worth. It is. Yes. Yeah. This is because they are called that. They are named after the Duke of Wellington, who popularized the shoe in 1817. This transformed the Wellington boot from military uniform to aristocrat fashion. However, do you know the Duke of Wellington is not his real name? Do you want to know the Duke of Wellington's real name, Ben?
No. What is it?
It is Arthur Wellesley.
No.
Yeah, Arthur Wellesley. I was like, no, it is not.
That's not a mistake.
That can't be a mistake. That cannot be a mistake that Arthur Wellesley, that Arthur Weasley owns Wellington boots, right?
That is a nod if I've ever seen one.
I was like, I know. I was like, I read that yesterday, but I was like, that is the most obscure, one of the most obscure Easter eggs I've ever found.
That is so random, but yes. that can't be a mistake.
It cannot be.
Too big of a coincidence.
Arthur Wellesley.
Does this man have a legacy of any kind?
Well, he was the Duke of Wellington, and the boots are named after him, so.
So there's that.
There's that, yeah. I mean.
Was he known for tinkering with anything?
I don't, you know, I didn't look too much more into Arthur Wellesley's, like wiki file or anything.
Okay.
But perhaps I shall.
I'm going to dangerously assume that he was a kind-hearted lad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see.
Okay.
Okay. Seems like he must have been like an aristocrat. I don't know. Well, obviously.
Right. Yeah.
Based on being a duke.
Based on being
sort of the opposite of Arthur. But
Right. Yeah.
But like, that's too close to the name.
It is. That feels like.
But then you're like, is that where the Weasley name came from? That can't be right either.
It would seem so odd, you're right, because it would definitely feel like the fact that they live in the borough and their last name is Weasley, which is sort of like a creature that would live like a weasel in a borough.
Yeah.
Like and there's so many of them.
Yeah.
Like it feels like there's like obvious like reasons, but we don't ever know what the jumping off point was.
There you go.
Got to start somewhere.
Well, it feels like no accident if that's the reason that the word Wellington boots, capital W Wellington, you know, is put in here as like a bit, because it could easily just say that the gnome dived headlong into one of the Weasley's boots,
and it would have been fine.
And it would have been fine. You wouldn't have been like, what kind of boot? I don't even understand. Why do they even own boots?
Right.
You
know? Right.
You wouldn't think that. You wouldn't. You know, this is in here for a reason. I think that's the reason.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I also underlined it and highlighted
it. Because it's not a very magical word.
It's not. No, you're right. You're right. It's like hamburger.
It's sticks out like a sore hamburger, as I always say.
I love it.
All right. So Crookshanks continues to be terrible at hunting. And now we get to see Bill and Charlie, both other wands out. We're making two battered old tables fly high above the lawn, smashing into each other, each attempting to knock the other out of the air. I also love that the Weasleys, this is exactly how like outdoor family things go. It's never just one big table. Like, you always have multiple tables.
Yeah. You know, that's great.
Like, they're sort of mismatched. Even my Thanksgiving dinner that we just hosted had mismatched tables as like the big table.
Right. Yeah. It's the way that when families are getting all together and they're having a big gathering, it's like, it's what you do.
Yeah. You just got a bunch of tables.
Who just has a table that big?
Exactly.
Yeah. But then you kind of get like continuing on this vein of the dichotomy of the Weasleys. You got Fred and George are cheering. Ginny was laughing, and Hermione was hovering near the hedge, apparently torn between amusement and anxiety.
Ah, classic Hermione.
I know, yeah, which is really funny because, I mean, Hermione, obviously not a Weasley, at least not by blood. But To me, it's very funny because it's like she also has sort of got like a little bit of this like foot in both fields situation.
Yeah. No wonder Ron likes her.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Nobody would think it would be a far cry to compare Hermione and Percy as being moderately cut from the same cloth.
But this is early Hermione, on, especially
early on, especially. But this is Hermione having like a little bit more whimsy granted in her favor than Percy usually has.
Absolutely. But speaking of Percy, he does stick his head out the window. Will you keep it down? And then I love the exchange with Bill.
Yes.
Sorry, Percy. How are the cauldron bottoms coming on? Because like Bill and Charlie are probably the only two people on the planet who could get away with talking to Percy this way. Who hold like a position of like superiority in the family over him, but aren't the parents.
Exactly. Because
like if Fred and George do this, like Percy could just like talk down to them because he's their older brother and not take them seriously.
Right.
But like Bill and Charlie have the ability to like totally mess with him, but there's nothing he can do.
Yes, yes. I was like, I feel like somehow Percy giving, or somehow Bill giving Percy a hard time almost like validates like my own annoyances with Percy.
Exactly. It's like
okay, well, Bill's saying.
He gets it. Yeah.
It must be fine.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's so funny. And then here we get, yeah, you were right about the time of day. Ben says, by 7 o'clock, the two tables were groaning. Nice use of the word groaning.
Yep.
Under the dishes and dishes of Mrs. Weasley's excellent cooking. And the 9 Weasleys, Harry and Hermione, because no one else is allowed to invite friends over, were settling them down to eat beneath a clear, deep blue sky.
Yeah, poor Lee Jordan is like, what the heck?
I know, come on, man.
Ron gets 2 friends.
I know, Ginny down there, you know, like, hey, come on. Hey, what can I bring someone to the World Cup?
Luna's just around the corner there.
Yeah.
Ottery St. Catchpole.
Exactly.
Catchpole.
Exactly. Ottery St. Catchpole.
Anyway.
And we know she's going.
Yeah, we know she's going. Yeah. You're right. To somebody who had been living on meals of increasingly stale cake somewhere else, increasingly stale cake all summer, this was paradise.
It does
sound really amazing.
Oh, I know, it makes me very hungry, and as we're recording, it's approaching lunchtime and I'm like, we gotta get some food.
I know. Where do we help ourselves to some chicken, ham pie, boiled potatoes and salad?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if anywhere in downtown.
I know. We don't have anywhere downtown that has like a family style service, do we?
Yet. This is the moment.
This is it.
We'll call it the Weasley's Diner.
Oh, I love that. The Wellesley's.
Yeah. The Wellesley's, yes. We'll have Wellington boots aligning the exterior.
Percy commits a hilarious self-own here as well, I think.
Okay.
And that he says... or he's talking to his dad, and he says, I've told Mr. Crouch I'll have it ready by Tuesday. That's a bit sooner than expected, but I like to keep on top of things. You know, it's extremely busy in our department just now, well, with all the arrangements for the World Cup, which, in case you have forgotten, is tomorrow.
Yeah,
okay? Right. So, like, this is the cell phone, is that his department, the International, you know, Magical Cooperation, that's where he works, okay? The biggest event of the last 30 years is happening tomorrow in your home country, and your boss, who you look up to, doesn't even have you working on that. Okay.
Right.
Like you don't realize that you have been shunted, my man.
Yes.
Like why aren't you at the World Cup right now? You like absolutely without a doubt, every other person in that department is already there setting up.
Yes.
Like it is so funny to me that Percy is like taking this so seriously and is not questioning why he's not helping at the World Cup when people have been camping out there for a week at this point, you know?
There are things that he could have been doing.
Yes, absolutely.
And you might even think like, well, no, I mean, is that possible? But I mean, Crouch doesn't even know his name. Like,
exactly.
100% he's just been pushed into a corner.
Yes, absolutely.
But then he goes on to say, we're not getting the support we need from the Department of Magical Games and Sports. Ludo Bagman, and this is another moment where I feel like we're seeing that like the Fred and George side of like the Arthur brand. It's like, I like Ludo, said Mr. Weasley mildly. He was the one who got us such a good tickets to the World Cup. I did him a bit of a favor. His brother Otto got into a spot of trouble. A lawnmower with unnatural powers. I smoothed the whole thing over. And it's like, this is, I feel like Mr. Weasley being like, before you say anything bad about him, it's like, I do kind of like him.
Yeah, especially Percy here, who, by the way, just attends the World Cup, right? his department is running it, and he doesn't even have to work it. Right. He just goes.
He just gets the go, yeah.
He just gets the go and sit in the top box. Mind you, again, this is his department. Percy is not the one who got the tickets.
Right.
Right? Like, Ludo Bagman just got you the best tickets in the whole stadium, and you're like, oh, he's likable enough, but I don't even know about him.
Oh, yeah. He's likable enough, said Percy dismissively.
Dismissively, as if he didn't just get you amazing tickets.
Yeah.
Anyway, Percy. But let's see. And then then we get a little bit of a Bertha Jorkins update here. It says, I can't see Mr. Crouch losing a member of our department and not trying to find out what happened to them. You realize Bertha Jorkins been missing for over a month now? It's so surprising because Harry here clearly hears Percy say Bertha Jorkins, and it is just, if only hearing the name had like stirred Harry's memory into, I know who killed her. But it doesn't.
Yeah. And it's because we've had three chapters of basically nothing but filler.
I know.
I say that as if we haven't gotten hours of entertainment out of them.
Oh, I know. Right.
But you're right. Like it is very interesting because this is the first mention of Bertha Jorkins since chapter one. And the real question is, for first-time savvy readers, did the light bulb go off?
I know. Were you like, ooh, I remember.
I remember. Yeah. Because, I don't know. Maybe.
Because otherwise, you're like, do I even care about Bertha Jorkins?
Who is this Bertha Jorkins character?
Who is she? Yeah. But then this is like, if you really have reread it a bunch, it says, yes, I was asking Ludo about that. He says Bertha's gotten lost plenty of times before now, which even that's not like that's not a thing, right? Like adults aren't just like frequently lost, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
Right. Like this isn't like, what do you mean she's just gotten lost? She's like, I don't even know where I was. I was here.
I got back.
Right. But it's like, here's the sauce on top of that is that the reason she's getting lost is because Mr. Crouch erased her memory. He like messed with her mind.
Well, that's the other thing too, though, is that like this is all happening in a rather short period of time because the reason that Bertha Jorkins is at, and I think Percy's even going to say this, it's like Mr. Crouch has been taking a personal interest because she worked in our department at one time. When it says that at one time, this was about a month ago. Because it hasn't, or maybe 2 months ago, but like it hasn't been that long because the reason that Bertha Jorkins is at the Crouch resident is to deliver papers that need to be signed by Mr. Crouch. Something you would only imagine she'd be doing if she worked in his department.
Yeah.
While she's there, she's going to observe Barty Crouch Jr.
Right.
And that is the reason why Barty Crouch Sr. needs to modify
her memory.
Her memory.
Yes.
Which then Voldemort is able to then crack through. But basically it means that, he had her show up at his house doing her job. She finds out a piece of information. He then sends her off to a different department altogether where she promptly goes missing.
I know, exactly. And it's like, how lucky is Voldemort that this person who is apparently just not that vital to the operation of the department is the one who goes missing and is someone who is just like known for being kind of like lost, I guess, all the time?
Yeah.
It's like, because if she'd been more vital, if they hadn't just like considered this routine, like, you know, they'd be looking for her a lot harder.
Yeah.
You know, and they're just not, like, no one's taking it seriously, which is like all to Voldemort's advantage.
It is all to Voldemort's advantage. And it's also shocking to me that the such high rankings of the department of or the Ministry of Magic, rather, know that she went on holiday to Albania, where she went missing, and that is the last known hiding spot.
Oh, I know.
Of Voldemort.
Like, it's a giant red flag.
Yeah, it's like, guys, somebody from the ministry went missing where Voldemort supposedly is. Like,
yeah.
We should be focusing on that.
Yes. Also, when it says Mr. Crouch has been taking a personal interest because she worked in our department, he's taking a personal interest because he knows what she knows.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yes. And I highlighted that exact same line. I said, yes, he has, but not for the reasons that you think.
Right. Percy. Not because he's concerned about her. It's because he's concerned about himself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go. And then Percy does just the worst job ever of like dropping hints about the Triwizard Tournament, where he says, like, we've got another event to organize right after the World Cup. You know the one I'm talking about, Father. And he's like, the top secret one. Like, clearly trying to get someone to bite about it. So, like, but clearly not that secret. I don't know why it's a secret at all. Like, Malfoy is going to show up. He knows about it. No problem.
I know. You know? I mean, that feels like the kind of thing, like, where any typical professional would know better than to, like, go and share that piece of information. But I feel like Lucius thinks he's, like, giving Draco an advantage by, like, giving him that information.
Well, I almost can't believe, because Charlie must know about it too, because he's going to like help bring the dragons.
True.
For the first task or whatever. I can't believe Charlie doesn't just speak up and just like ruin it for Charlie. What, you mean the Triwizard Tournament purse? You know, like, I am shocked he doesn't do that.
I mean, he must be distracted with something else.
I know.
Interesting that's going on. Yeah. I think that must be our headcanon, because otherwise you're right.
I can tell you that's what I would do. Oh, wait. Oh, let's see. I love this particular line here. It says, Ron rolled his eyes and muttered to Harry and Hermione. He's been trying to get us to ask what that event is as if he started at work. Probably an exhibition of thick bottom cauldrons, which I just highlighted and said, oh, spicy.
Spicy. Yeah. Yeah. Heck yeah.
All right.
You can't miss it.
You can't miss it. It's right there. We know what you mean.
Oh, man.
You know, Percy's really up there just advocating for more, like, wizard squats, you know? I hope people are getting this joke. Oh, man. Anyway, moving on. So we find out that Mrs. Weasley is a little more concerned about Bill. Indeed, she says, Mom, no one gives, no one cares how I look as long as I bring home plenty of treasure, which that's very cool, too. I'm like, oh, what you do is hunt treasure. That's awesome. That's
a real super cool. Indiana Jones vibes going on there. Yeah.
But clearly, despite her not being upset with his career, she still is upset with his appearance.
His appearance. Yeah. And again, you know, this is another one where we're getting like the split, you know, Weasley thing, because like Mrs. Weasley doesn't like how he is, you know, presenting himself to the world. But then Ginny chimes in and she's like, I like it. You're so old fashioned, Mom.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think that's like a little sign that like Ginny has got like a bit more of like that Fred and George.
Yeah.
Leaning side to her.
Right. And then we get to hear some over conversation about how the Quidditch World Cup, the thing is going to go. Charlie says, it's got to be Ireland, through a mouthful of potato, which is kind of how Ron talks a lot of the time, too, like with his mouthful.
You're right. Yep. Yep. That's a good point.
And then, you know, they flatten Peru in the semifinals. And then Fred responds back, well, Bulgaria's got Victor Krum, which is our first mention of him. So if you're like keeping track in this chapter, we have been introduced to Barty Crouch, to Ludo Bagman, and to Victor Krum.
True.
Like all before we're going to meet them.
You're right. You're right. These are the seeds you kind of mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah.
But then we discover that apparently England just, you know, absolutely got annihilated.
Annihilated by Transylvania.
Yeah.
390-10. Even if they've caught the snitch, what, twice, they would have lost this game.
Yes.
They are like, getting like destroyed.
What went down here?
What went down? The way that score reads to me is two really bad seekers on and one set of very good chasers. Right? Like both the seekers are having trouble catching the snitch, but Transylvania still scores what? A ton of points.
204. Yeah. 24 quaffles.
24 quaffles worth of points.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was embarrassing. It is embarrassing.
Yes, it is.
I mean, like, England must be made up of mostly Hogwarts students, right?
You would think.
You would think.
And Oliver Wood didn't even make the team.
Exactly. Come on, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so then we get the reminder that Harry has the Firebolt, which will also come up here in the next couple of chapters, because we'll see that Ireland has all of them.
Yep.
Something that got set up in... Actually, I think all the players have them.
Do yes.
They have the Firebolts? They do.
Also, this is another reminder that like Harry's specifically good at flying, because there won't be Quidditch this year, but there will be dragon fighting.
Dragon fighting!
Yes.
Yep, then we have homemade strawberry ice cream, which I highlighted just because it sounds delicious.
Sounds delicious and sounds like good trivia. I was like, homemade strawberry ice cream? Oh, I really got to get some food, man.
I know.
I'm really hungry.
Apparently, I am starving.
Yes.
Finally, Ron and Harry and Hermione have the opportunity. So, have you heard from Sirius lately?
Oh, wait, no. We missed one thing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Ready? Okay, it says, we're getting just the description of the scene, and it says, moths were fluttering low over the table, and the warm air was perfumed with smells of grass and honeysuckle. Do you think that's what the Amortentia smells like to Harry?
Oh.
The flowery scent from the burrow? Because obviously it smells like Ginny, but like...
smells like Ginny, yeah.
But like
yeah.
this, you
That's
think
it.
This is it?
The honeysuckle.
The honeysuckle is the flowery scent?
It must be. It must be, because I think Hermione specifically smells grass.
Yeah.
And...
oh.
And she's being reminded of Ron.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Sold.
I think that...
I'm pretty sold.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, that's the real trivia question is not what Harry smells, but specifically what flower is it based on the powers of deduction?
Oh, dude, honeysuckle does smell amazing.
It does.
It is a great smell.
It is fragrant as well. It's like you can't miss it if it's there.
Dude, we had like a honeysuckle bush outside our house when we were growing up.
We did. We'd go out there and we just like suck the little honeysuckles.
Oh, it was amazing. It was great. Yeah.
It was great.
Every kid needs to do that.
I at least once.
Yeah.
Or 47,000
times. I was like, once?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so then you get the question. So have you heard from Sirius lately? Harry does tell him he sounds okay. I wrote to him yesterday. He might write back while I'm here. And then he suddenly remembers the reason that he had written to Sirius and for a moment was on the verge of telling Ron and Hermione about his scar hurting and about the dream that had woken him, which is interesting because he wants to tell him about the dream, but the Bertha Jorkins thing jogged no memory whatsoever.
Nothing.
So.
Yeah.
He must remember like bits and pieces, but definitely not all of it as it kind of like slips through that colander.
Well, I guess to him, maybe it was still just a dream, you know?
It's true, but yeah. I mean, if you remember the name Bertha Jorkins, that would have to...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Harry's got pretty good... We've pointed out a lot in Prisoner of Azkaban, but he's got pretty good instincts for stuff like this.
Yeah, he does.
So, like, when you know, if it came up, he should have marked it.
Yeah.
But he, this is like one of those moments where Harry's like, he didn't want to worry everybody, not when he was just feeling so happy and peaceful, which you always love for Harry, like whenever he kind of gets...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I highlighted that line, too. I just said, oh, I know the feeling.
Like, yes, yeah.
Like, when you're just like, nah, everyone's having too much fun. I'll just keep by... you know, my news to myself.
Exactly.
Yeah, whatever.
Exactly.
Yes. Let's see. They're talking about the length of the Quidditch match, and they said last time it lasted 5 days. And Harry is like, yeah, I hope it does this time. And I'm like, absolutely, that'd be so cool.
It would be so cool.
It'd be so fun. And Percy says, well, I certainly don't, said Percy sanctimoniously. I shudder to think what the state of my in-tray would be if I was awake from work for 5 days, to which I was like, wouldn't literally everyone be away from work for 5 days?
I know.
You could have no in-tray.
It's like, this is like a public holiday at this point in time.
It's like
everybody's not there. Who is going to be sending you stuff?
Yeah. Like your work tray, again, your department is running the event. So your work, if you ever start having it, is just going to be at the cup.
Yes.
Also, you could just leave. You know,
you
don't have to stay. Yeah,
nobody's forcing you to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What are your priorities, Percy? Quidditch or work? Hmm?
Right.
Hmm?
Exactly.
Sounds like Quidditch in this moment. That's what I'm saying.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
I also just follow it up with a yes, Percy. I too shudder.
Shudder to think.
Yeah. I love this line though, because I feel like this is like the capstone on the Weasley split for the whole chapter. Somebody might slip dragon dung in the inn again, eh, Percy? And that was a sample of fertilizer from Norway, said Percy, going very red in the face. It was nothing personal.
Yeah.
It was. Fred whispered to Harry as a guy from the table. We sent it.
I love that Percy is like, he knows he was the butt of a joke, but is like rationalized it. Like it to like has found a way to rationalize it outwardly, but doesn't realize he's talking to the prankster.
To the prankster.
Yeah.
I know. It's so good.
It's very funny.
Such good Fred and George stuff.
Yes, such good Fred and George
stuff. Perfect. It's perfect.
But there you go. That is going to bring us to the end of chapter 5.
I don't know what we're going to do when we start getting into some of these meatier chapters.
Where real things happen?
Yeah, we're almost going to need like 2 episodes per important chapter at some point in time. So
we'll see, Ben. I don't know.
We'll see what happens. Do you have a review for us?
I sure do, Ben. This comes from Yummy 87.
Yummy.
Which I thought said my ummy, but the Y is obviously not part of my. It's just yummy.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, there it is. I got it. There's a red. The middle M is capitalized, which is throwing me off.
I can see how that could happen.
So here's the review. It says, thank you. I've officially reached my late 30s and sometimes feel self-conscious for loving Harry Potter so much, but this podcast helps me connect to others and let me think critically, which is exactly the point.
Yes, it is.
My 6th grade teacher read the first 2 books to us when then she got bored and decided to start reading other stuff. Even though Prisoner had just been released and we all booed her. Anyway, in Goblet, Voldemort specifically says that some people know what steps he took to become immortal. And then I asked myself, but how could they have believed I would not rise again? They who knew the steps I took long ago to guard myself against mortal death. They who had seen the proofs of my immensity of my power in the times when I was mightier than any other wizard living. So Dumbledore, though, doesn't think he shared the information with anyone, but he says he did. Obviously, he doesn't have friends, so with whom did he share the steps? Bellatrix, Barty Crouch Jr., Snape, someone who died via Auror, obviously not Lucius. Grammatically, he told more than one person, so Horcruxes do him no good if he can't get to one, so someone else had to know of at least one. So who was it, and who would he trust enough to tell?
Who?
Okay. There you go.
I mean, it's a great question, because it does seem as though it's suggesting that Voldemort has revealed bits of information, and I like their list there. They did like a little bit of the homework for us, because at the very least we know that Bellatrix is hiding Hufflepuff's cup
right
in her vault. We don't know how long it's been there, so I guess that's something that could have happened.
I presume that it's been there like since before he fell.
Yeah, I mean that would be my guess as well.
Yeah,
I guess we just can't say with absolute certainty.
We can't, but yeah.
I would agree with you. And then we would also know that Regulus would have sort of like that like tenuous touch to yep. what was going on through usage of creature.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of like what he was doing in the cave to plant the locket. And, you know, Regulus went so far as to discover the locket itself.
Yeah.
However, in the note that he leaves, I think he says, like, I've discovered your secret.
Yeah, so like he... So Voldemort obviously told Creature, but then he thought Creature died, but Creature didn't.
Right.
And then Regulus goes in there, and he gets the locket and sends Creature away with it, but then Regulus doesn't escape either, and Voldemort never knows he was there.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, Regulus is where my mind went at first as well, but clearly it's not him.
It would seem unlikely based on the phrasing of the note.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it would. It seems like... Like, you'd have to think, it feels like Bellatrix and Barty Crouch and Rodolphus and Rodolphus's brother, whatever his name is, Rabastin, are the best candidates, because they are, in fact, the ones who remain loyal after the fall and are, like, positive that he will rise again. Like, Bellatrix even tells Crouch in the courtroom, that's like, the Dark Lord will rise again, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. It's true. And then, and, I mean, the other thing that we know about Barty Crouch Jr. is that he sort of hates that, like, nothing makes me more upset than a Death Eater who walked free.
Yeah.
And it's like when he says that, you think it's Moody being, like, frustrated that these criminals were able to like, go and live their lives.
Yeah.
But the reality is that Barty Crouch Jr. is expressing this sentiment, and he's like, true followers should have been true.
Yeah.
Like it infuriates him that like Lucius goes and like lives a life, you know, like
right.
not in service of the Dark Lord.
Yeah. But it's like, but then he does give, he gives Bellatrix the cup. And when Bellatrix finds out or thinks she's found out that the trio have been in her vault and stolen the sword, she does freak out.
She does.
So, like, it is possible that Bellatrix knows about that the cup is a Horcrux.
Okay.
We don't know for sure. We can't say that with certainty. Lucius obviously didn't know the diary was a Horcrux.
In Dumbledore himself says, like, he wouldn't have handled it so carelessly.
Yeah.
Had he known what he actually possessed. The real question is like, the phrasing suggests that whatever the Death Eaters knew was that he had taken steps to achieve immortality. It doesn't, which alludes to the knowledge of the Horcruxes, but I guess it doesn't explicitly state that they would have known that he was creating Horcruxes.
That's true. He says, who knew the steps I'd taken to guard myself against death?
Right, right. I'm trying to think then, like, okay, so, because here's
but like
the other.
Horcruxes aren't just like an unknown thing. If you're, you know,
if you're deep into the dark arts,
right.
you would probably just know of their existence. I mean, case in point is Slughorn.
Obviously Slughorn knows.
Yeah, and I mean, he's just a teacher and happens to know about it. He's not even necessarily infatuated with the dark arts.
Right.
So
that, and clearly that's not who he means, because he's talking about the Death Eaters, which Slughorn isn't.
Right, right. So the curiosity to me, though, is that if you can use the precedent of Voldemort asking Regulus for usage of his house elf to hide the locket, is there any argument to be made that any of the other Death Eaters were... I mean, and then Bellatrix would be used to plant the cup in her vault.
Yeah.
Like, is there any argument to be made for, like, the people that are with Tom Riddle, when he goes and asks Dumbledore for the position for DADA professor, it's the same night that he hides the diadem. Like, is he tasking somebody with hiding the diadem?
No, I think he hides it.
You think he does?
I think he hides it.
So he like leaves Dumbledore's office and goes and like accesses the room of requirement. And,
yeah.
Or the room of hidden things.
Yeah. Because otherwise he'd be revealing the hiding place too, I guess. But
I guess that's true. Yeah. Because he does say like the room that he had only found because he had plundered the secrets of the castle.
Yeah, the castle more than anyone else, which is obviously not true. I think based on the evidence we have, we can he seems like disappointed with the people present, you know? Like, I want to say, like, to me, the most likely candidates are that Bellatrix Lestrange group who comes into the courtroom.
They're the ones who tortured the Longbottoms.
Yeah, they're the one who tortured the Longbottoms. They were the ones who were like, oh, he fell, no big deal. He's obviously coming back. Like, it seems like they would have reason to think he's coming back. Like, we know he took steps. And, like, she tells Barty Crouch he'll rise again. We already know Bellatrix is hiding an item of importance. I mean, it's possible that, like, he gave it to her and it's like, this will help me stay alive, even if she doesn't know it's a Horcrux or something. But he seems upset with the people in the circle. Like, he would know that the people in, like, that particular section of people is still in Azkaban.
Yes. And I think you're right. And he does say that, like, his most trusted supporter is still at Hogwarts, which I think we're supposed to think is Snape inside of that moment.
No, I think it's Barty Crouch.
No, it is Barty Crouch.
Yeah.
Who are we supposed to think it is?
Oh, I don't think we're supposed to know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just someone. Okay. Because at that point in time, we would know at least that Snape and Karkaroff were at Hogwarts.
Well, we certainly know it's not Snape who knows about the Horcruxes, because he would definitely tell Dumbledore.
He definitely would. Yeah. So there's that piece is definitely the case. So,
I mean, Lucius doesn't know, and he, by all accounts, seems to be second in command.
Yes.
Right? Which maybe that's a role that he's only being given since he's not in Azkaban, though. Like, is it possible that one of those would have been more... But, like, he was given the diary. Like, why would he give anyone besides his second in command the diary? Like, you'd have to be the highest ranking, you'd think.
You would think so.
Especially because Bellatrix seems to be that on the female side of things.
Right. Well, Lucius brings a lot to the table that isn't his magical prowess, because it's like, it never seems like Lucius is like a particularly like great wizard.
Yeah.
Versus Bellatrix, who I think is terrible but great.
Yeah.
You know, like she can do extraordinary things. I think Barty Crouch Jr., Bellatrix, and maybe the Lestrange siblings,
brothers.
Yeah. But maybe not them, because I mean the fact that like Bellatrix seems to uphold the mantle of that Lestrange name in such a big way makes me feel like she was almost marrying into that for, of course, all of the wrong reasons.
Oh, I know. Like, she's like, you know, they've been in my vault. And it's like, well, you married into that vault, you know?
Right. Yeah. She maybe wears the cloak in that relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think that's the best argument you could make.
I think so.
Without more information, because you would know that Bellatrix is directly involved. And you would know that Voldemort was not above asking for help in hiding the Horcruxes, so someone theoretically would have helped him.
Yeah.
Because we, at bare minimum, we know Creature and Bellatrix. Must have. So.
Yes. And then, Lucius has a diary, but doesn't know it's a Horcrux, so.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Great question, though.
Great question.
Because it is weird phrasing, unless there is, you know, believed to be other methodologies beyond the Horcruxes, but certainly from a plot perspective, the Horcruxes are the key and most fundamental and important steps he had taken to ensure his immortality.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I think that's going to bring us to the end of today's episode. Make sure you join us next week for Chapter 6, The Port Key, here on Through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager, and the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Y'all, I am so excited because Through the Gryffindor is heading back out on tour. Starting in February of 2025, we'll be performing live shows in Charlotte, Orlando, Tampa, Jacksonville, Atlanta, and Nashville. And as always, we will be bringing all of the magic with a tour-long Jay versus Ben trivia showdown with questions submitted and asked by all of you. And then, of course, we will dim the lights for a live recording of Through the Gryffindor. And y'all, these nights have made for some of my all-time favorite since we have started making content on the internet. It is truly a magical evening, nerding out Harry Potter style with the very best community online. Plus, we have a VIP upgrade for each show if you want to come and meet Jay and I, take photos, ask questions, and score an exclusive signed tour poster before the show begins. We would love to see you. We'd love to meet you, and we hope you will come and join us for all of the fun. Tickets are available in the show notes for every show or at supercarlinbrothers.com. Super Carlin Brothers is sponsored by Nude. Y'all, of course, know about my podcasting and YouTube endeavors, and you may even know that I do some aquarium maintenance at times, but you may not be aware that my wife, Alice, and I also own a business together called Nude. I know it's a funny name, but there's actually a fun story behind it. See, Alice has always had a deep love for clothing and fashion, but even more so for thrifting. It was her way to sustainably and economically expand her wardrobe while still aiming for quality brands that would last. And she is really good at it. Like, I can't tell you the number of times over the years that she has been stopped by people admiring her finds. So much so that she coined a phrase for her response. Thanks, it's nude. As in new, but in the past tense, because it's not exactly new, it's nude. So, we took this concept and created a storefront not 100 yards from where Super Carlin Brothers was created and have an online shop featuring pre-loved clothing from brands like Lululemon, Free People, Anthropologie, Madewell, and so many more. If you'd like to check it out for yourself to ring in the nude year, if you will, you can do so at nudesalem.com and use promo code SUPER to get 20% off your entire order. That's NEWDSalem.com, promo code SUPER for 20% off.